Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mullick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yaman. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mullick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are now listening to Archive Radio.
Tonight on Treasures from the KBOO Vault, we will go back to 1990 and to 2003 to remember the November 13, 1988 killing of Mulugeta Sarah by members of the Portland neo-Nazi group Eastside White Pride. We will listen to a recording made in 1990 at an anti-Tom Metzger rally and to a speech made by author Eleanor Langer in 2003 upon the release of her highly acclaimed book, 100 Little Hitlers. Stay tuned. On November 12, 1988, a group of Portland, Oregon skinheads known as Eastside White Pride encountered three Ethiopians in a street fight, which took place on Southeast 31st Avenue and resulted in the brutal death of Mulugeta Sarah. In 1990, Ken Death Meskey was convicted of first-degree murder. He died in prison in July 2011. Kyle Brewster and Steve Strasser were convicted of manslaughter and assault. After the men were sentenced in 1990, white supremacist Tom Metzger and his son John Metzger were sued civilly on behalf of Sarah's family by the Southern Poverty Law Center. This recording, made by an anonymous KBOO volunteer in 1990, was at the courthouse where Tom Metzger was filing a countersuit against the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Here's the deal. This group, this civil rights group in the South, is suing Metzger, okay, for the death of Sarah, for undisclosed amount. But they're saying that he violated civil rights. That he there are three charges against him. Anyway, they're basically saying he was involved in killing Sarah through these skinheads. And what he's doing now is he's saying they're just trying to get me for defamation of character, okay? And they're just trying to, like, smear my name and make money for themselves. So I'm countersuing for $10 million. And this is some sort of a preliminary pretrial hearing on that lawsuit.
Nazis and the KKK, civil rights are here to stay.
Stop the Nazis and the KKK.
Why are you here?
Because I think that the world that the Nazis want is a very ugly world.
If you could say something to Tom Metzger, what would you say to him?
Well, I wouldn't try to talk to Tom Metzger. His mind is made up, you know. I would say I don't understand why he hates people of color so much. I think it would be a very dull world if it was all homogenous the way he wants it. I think we have to, you know, there are problems in this society, and we need to look to the victims of those problems in order to find leadership in solving them. And to eliminate those people means we won't solve the problems.
And now Scott's a good person to talk to.
Okay. You want to say something for KBOO? What you want to accomplish here? What's going on here?
What we want to accomplish here? We want to make it really clear that we oppose the sort of terror that Tom Metzger represents in this city. We don't like being intimidated, and we're going to stand up to it. You know, we realize, though, that this court battle is, you know, just a very small part of what of the struggles that we're facing. Civil rights have been rolled back, and people aren't being supported in the city. And the kind of activity that Tom Metzger represents is only a small part of, you know, just a larger movement to the right in the city and in the nation in general.
Can you tell me more about what actually is going on today in the courthouse?
Metzger's filing a countersuit, and they're here today to see if those Morris Dees is here today, actually, to see if that can be dismissed, if his countercharges can be dismissed. I suspect they will be. They're fairly irrelevant, I would.
The countercharges?
Yeah.
Wig and have him in there in a bald head, say, I'm not a skinhead. I'm not a Nazi. Yeah, well, I'd grab his wig and make a mad dash.
He's just a white separatist, that's all he is.
He's a closet skin.
Stop the Nazis, ban the Klan, end the lynching in our land. Stop the Nazis, ban the Klan, end the lynching in
our
land.
Well, I'm here because I think that the skinhead threat has become pretty overwhelming in Portland. I've been harassed by skinheads. They've called me a dyke and other names that they think are derogatory. I don't really mind being called a dyke, but when the threat of violence goes with that, and when people are insulting each other, oh, I'm not ready to talk.
No neo-Nazis! No neo-Nazis! No neo-Nazis! No neo-Nazis!
No neo-Nazis! No neo-Nazis!
We hope to accomplish the getting Portland to unite, to stand up, you know, in a very visible and united way against the growth of the Nazi skinheads, against the racist organizing that's been going on in Portland and Oregon. If you don't stand up to Nazis, they grow. It's very important that when they pop their heads up, that you turn up in force and you tell them to basically to get out of town, that their ideology is completely unacceptable, that we're not going to let them beat and terrorize and harass the city and the Northwest.
Have you had any personal contact with Tom Metzger? I mean,
only not personal, but I was at Whidbey Island when he and Butler and other fascists and Nazis were gathering together to honor that Robert Matthews, who was that Nazi leader who died in that thing with the FBI. When Whidbey Island was that protest, I was there, but they waited till everybody left before they turned up. So I have never met Tom Metzger. I'm not sorry either.
By standing out here, you want to be assigned to the community as well.
That yes, absolutely. That we have to get together and stand up against them. That when they appear somewhere, we have to be there at the same place at the same time in force. Because otherwise, see, they grow on fear. They are our minority. Their philosophy is very, very reactionary and is very hateful toward everybody. But if people don't oppose them, they grow because they build on fear, on terror. And we're the vast majority, and if we get together and say no to them face to face, they can't grow.
There's a couple groups here today, aren't there?
Yes, a lot of different groups. There's the Coalition for Human Dignity that has called this protest. I'm with Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party. The Socialist Workers Party is represented here. You should talk to them about them, though. There's a lot of different groups and individuals. The ARA is here also. There's a lot of different organizations here. And it would be a good idea probably to talk to the representatives of them as to why they're here. Are you from Cable? Okay, if I had one message, it would be let's all get together. The labor movement, the lesbian, gay, feminist movement, the black movement, Native Americans, everybody get together and stand up against the Klan and the Nazis and the skinheads when and where they appear.
1, 2, 3, 4, civil rights or civil war. 1, 2, 3, 4, civil rights or civil war. One, two, three, four.
Yeah, I've been trying to shut that radio station down for over a year.
On your own or with a...
Well, I did it on my own. I did it on my own at first. And I've been the guy, I'm the guy that calls up the radio stations all the time.
Oh, yeah. What, is that how you've been doing it? Just calling them? Or
I've been calling radio stations, and I've been giving people material to write. A year ago, Marge McCloskey, I gave her tapes to write Strange Radio. I gave Jill Smith some tapes to write the story, Do the White Thing. I gave Chris Phelps a bunch of tapes. He did Hate Radio. Plus, I call in the talk shows. I call everybody I know. And then I was barred from calling the station. They told me no more.
How could they bar you?
Well, you see what happens. Then the Christian conservatives call up. That's how these Nazis appear. They say I'm a Christian conservative, anti-communist, flag-burning ex-Marine, and I hate liberals. And then they spread their hate. They're very subtle whenever they do this. They call other stations. They're good Christian conservatives.
And what got you started doing this? I mean, what motivated you to take up this personal attempt to?
Because it's the right thing to do. I don't. I'm not gay. I'm not Jewish. I'm not black. And I thought I was doing this alone until I met the Coalition for Human Dignity. My family has been threatened. I got a wife and two children. We've been threatened. They're going to burn us out, kill us and everything.
Threatened by who?
By the neo-Nazis. And everybody says we should fight racism, but there's nobody wants to do nothing about it. People are ostriches. They put their head in the sand. And they don't want to do nothing about it. And there's a few people who are out there to stick their necks out, and some of them are getting them chopped off. Seems like every time this man comes into town, the scanner gets burned. Helene Rashan, who called me on the phone to thank me for what I'm doing, he called me to thank me. I keep in touch with the ADL, all the newspapers. I know almost all the reporters by heart. I call the ADL. I'm just doing all my best to try to shut this station down if it don't get a little bit. That's not conservatism, honey. That's right-wing loony hate. I called 100 people to come out here. One showed up. Now I know how Jesus felt when he says, where's the 99 or where's the 9?
We will stop you, yes we can. No more Hitlers, no more Klan. We will stop you, yes we can. No more Hitlers, no more Klan.
Basically, I guess it boils down to that I feel that people need to show the strongest resistance and unity against people such as Tom Metzger, but also realizing that he's not in a position of power in terms of the internal structure of the government, but there are plenty of people that are sympathetic or aiming at similar goals and within the governmental structure. So it's important to fight on both fronts and realize that people like Metzger, both inside and outside the system.
Nazis have got to go, hey, hey, ho, ho. Nazis have got to go, hey, hey, ho, ho.
Well, I hope to send a message to Tom Metzger that he's not wanted in Portland and that fascism and racism is not acceptable.
Well, selfish reasons, really. I think it's just that I'd like to save the world, you know. And this seems like a good place to start. You have to excise all the hatred and divisiveness and stuff. This is an obvious place.
Right. If you could say something to Tom Metzger, do you have anything that you would say to him?
Nothing that you should put on the radio.
Oh, we're into radical programming here.
KKK. MLK Boulevard is here to stay. Got to
go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. Nazi bigots have got to go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. Nazi bigots have got to go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. Nazi bigots have got to go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. Nazi bigots have got to go. Hey, hey.
You are listening to Treasures from the KABU Vault. We just finished listening to a Vox Pop recorded at a 1990 rally against Tom Metzger. We will now listen to a speech made at UC Santa Barbara on October 19th, 2003, by Eleanor Langer, Portland author who wrote the book 100 Little Hitlers.
100 Little Hitlers grew out of an event that people in Portland, and indeed in the Northwest, remember as well as I do, the killing of an Ethiopian man named Mulugeta Sarah by three Portland skinheads who were members of a neo-Nazi gang called East Side White Pride in November 1988. My own interest grew out of two kinds of closeness to the skinheads I turned out to have. One was geographical. The killing took place not very far from where I live, but even closer to where I lived when I first came to Portland, within a few blocks of that neighborhood. And second, what turned out to be my personal closeness to the three skinheads involved in the killing, by which I don't mean that I knew them, but my degrees of separation from them were not nearly what I would have expected from who they were and who I was. The first, one of them lived in my neighborhood a few blocks away in a building that I had recently considered taking an office in. One of them was the homecoming king of a local major public high school and the son of a prominent liberal civic activist in Portland whose good works, community activities, overlapped a fair amount with the good works of people that I knew. And the third, the actual killer, Ken Miske, was a rock musician who went by the name of Ken Death, stage name Ken Death, who was part of a bohemian artistic underculture in Portland that included a lot of writers and artists and filmmakers, the most prominent of whom was the one whose name you probably know is Gus Van Sant, who was then just starting out as a young filmmaker, young independent filmmaker in Portland, and other people who I knew then and knew now. And that was very surprising to, of course, to find that they were as close at hand as they really were. And many of those experiences or those relationships were true of other people in Portland, because Portland is really a small community. But unlike other people who were making those discoveries, I was a writer. I had a longstanding interest in political trials, and I also had a longstanding editorial relationship with The Nation, which made it possible for me to arrange very easily to cover the skinhead trial for The Nation, which was all I originally intended to do. In January 1989, I began going to the preliminary hearings. You know, to make a very long story short, it turned out that the trial that I was going to cover never took place. This lower, that would be great. I'm just reaching. Is that okay? Okay. More? Thank you. Wants to go up. There, okay, I got it. Okay. Okay. What first happened was that the trials were severed, the cases were severed from one another, meaning that there would be no joint trial. And then the cases were individually plea bargained, meaning that there was not going to be any trial at all. The reasons for the plea bargains are fundamental to what later unfolded and fundamental to the existence of my book, and I want to try to explain them a bit now. Some of what follows may be a little convoluted, but I will get back to the thread in due course. The most important reason for the plea bargains was the understanding on the part of the district attorney that the killing of Mulugeta Sarah had not taken place the way the public believed it had taken place. The killing was represented from the beginning as practically a lynching. It was represented as a hunting party of skinheads armed with bats out to get a black man. The killing, in fact, grew out of an accidental confrontation of two cars at 1:30 in the morning, a Sunday morning, after a Saturday night in which the people in both cars had been drinking. One car had three Ethiopian men in it. The other car had three skinhead men and three skinhead girls. The Ethiopians were parked in the middle of the street because the street, the curb sides were all full. They were parked in the middle of the street dropping Mulugeta Sarah off at his apartment when the skinhead car came head to head with it, couldn't get by. Words were exchanged. The racial element entered. People realized that, you know, some of them were black and some of them were white. A fight, they got out of their cars, a fight erupted, and very sadly, the last two people to enter the fight were Mulugeta Sarah, who ran down. He had gotten out of his car previously so the other cars could pass, but he ran down to where the fight was happening. And then Ken Miskey, was literally the last person to get out of the car, grabbing a bat that he did found on the floor of the car that he happened to be riding in, another unplanned occurrence, and Miskey took the bat and he brought it down on the side of Mulugeta Sarah's head, interrupting where he was fighting with another skinhead. Sarah fell to the ground. Miskey continued to hit him. One of the other skinheads came over and joined in, kicking him in the gut and in the head, and the skinheads ran away, and very shortly, Mulugeta Sarah was dead. So, you know, a horrible, brutal fight, but not an intentional one. I'm not going to take the time to explain all the reasons why it solidified into the image of the fight that it did. But it happened instantly. The first interviews with the Ethiopian survivors said that they had been attacked unprovoked with bats. That was the lead the police followed up. And more important, that image of the skinheads doing something that nobody else in town would dream of doing was vital to what people in Portland wanted to believe about the crime. And to understand that, you have to go back to the unique racial history of Oregon. That's why I said this was going to get convoluted. Oregon is literally the only state that was admitted to the Union with a clause in its constitution that not only excluded slavery, it excluded black people. Three other states, Iowa, Indiana, and Illinois, also excluded black people, but only Oregon had that in its constitution at the time it was admitted. That was not repealed until 1926. And in fact, the exclusion of black people from Oregon began even earlier with the with an 1843 organic law of the territory, which provided that should black people come into the territory, they would be beaten a certain number of times, at 39, every 6 months, until they got the idea and left. And in fact, it began even earlier with prohibitions on the emigration of blacks from the wagon trains in Iowa. Something called the Oregon Emigration Society of Iowa prohibited black people. So needless to say, with this kind of climate, the black population of Oregon remained minuscule, something that changed only in World War II, when black people came to work in the shipyards, after which a great many of them left, was still small again in the period after World War II. And it was only in the 60s and a little bit after that the few blacks that there were began to mobilize themselves, you know, to be a force at all in political life, which now is pretty much the case. Very sensitive period. 1988, the year Mulugeta Sarah was killed, Portland was, I believe, 88% white. It was known as the whitest big city in the United States. It's dropped a little bit in the next census, in the 2000 census. So this death occurred at a time of a rising black movement, a time of a lot of opposition, or first manifesting of opposition to police violence against the black community, and a time when Oregonians had more or less decided to forget about this racial history. It was a time when It could have come out usefully, but it didn't. And instead, the skinheads became a really convenient focus for Oregon racism. So no one cared about the misrepresentation of the killing. And this, the problem of the misrepresentation of the killing became worse 2 years later when Tom Metzger went on trial, was brought to trial by the Southern Poverty Law Center for the killing, because now not only were there these skinheads who don't have anything to do with us, there's an outside person, a Californian, on whom we can blame this killing. So we don't have to look at any of our own racial history. So all this was behind the plea bargain. You know, it is a long way about, but it's why the plea bargain was welcomed in the white community, though not, I have to say, in the black community and not by the Ethiopians. Those people would greatly have preferred a trial, which would have illuminated many things about the background culture that didn't come out.
You are listening to a speech by Eleanor Langer made in 2003 about the death of Mulugeta Seraa in November of 1988.
Instead, there was a demonization of the skinheads right from the start, which I can testify to personally, as I was in the these courtrooms. It was really impossible to say this grew out of a street fight. The lawyers couldn't say it. The press couldn't say it. Nobody could say it. It was unheard of. It was a picture of Ken Miskey in the Oregonian, a picture of all the defendants eating peanuts at the defense table one day, and the caption said, defendants Miskey and whoever sitting at the table eating salted peanuts, and the implication really was Satan is behind them. Satan is pouring the salt. No one but a demon would be eating peanuts when they were on trial for killing Mulugeta Seraa. So besides all the local reasons for the plea bargains, the Federal Justice Department was in the act. The skinhead movement was surfacing in a number of places around the country. The Justice Department was under pressure to seem to be doing something about it, and one of the things they chose to do something about was to work on getting a strong result in this Portland case. So there was that pressure. And thirdly, the Southern Poverty Law Center was behind the scenes trying to facilitate a plea bargain, actually. By the time these plea bargains took place, by the time it was clear there was no trial, I had already learned a great deal about the skinhead movement, both in Portland and somewhat nationally. Because of the smallness of the community, for a number of other reasons, people were willing to talk. So I began to get a pretty strong sense of the widespread and grassroots nature of the skinhead movement in the city, and particularly realized how dominant the skinhead culture had been in the city in the years between 1985 and 1988. It's important to realize that there were a number of violent skinhead crimes in that period. There was a lot of graffiti, synagogue trashing. The Portland neo-Nazi skinhead movement was very visible between those years. And it was only with Seraa's death that a stop came to it, that people began to sit up and notice it. So when the trial was canceled, to get back to the thread of my book, I didn't give up the story. I continued with the investigations of the local skinhead movement, and it became the special issue of The Nation, published in July 1990, called The American Neo-Nazi Movement Today. In the fall of 1990, the Southern Poverty Law Center brought its case against Tom Metzger. And I just want to remind you here, if you don't know anything about the case, that Tom Metzger chose to represent himself in this trial. And much of the critique that I have of the trial, I think, would not be necessary had he had a lawyer. I think it was a very unbalanced situation because of the self-representation, but so it's important to remember that. In any case, the trial was modeled after a famous Klan case that the Southern Poverty Law Center had just concluded the year before, that some of you may remember, the Donald case, in Mobile. A black man named Michael Donald in Mobile, young man, had actually been lynched. He'd gone out to get a pack of cigarettes. And three Klansmen, who were members of a local Klan organization, who were in turn part of an Alabama Klan organization, had decided in advance to lynch a black man that night in response to a jury decision they didn't like in a case of a white policeman having been killed in Mobile. And they went out and lynched him, and they hung him from a tree. And the killing was practically signed KKK. There were very, very few questions about it after a while. I mean, initially it wasn't even tried as a Klan case criminally, but eventually it was. And Dees had the idea of establishing liability not just of the individuals, but of the Klan organization. And he successfully did that, and you probably remember the awarding of the Klan headquarters in Tuscaloosa to Beulah Mae Donald, the mother of Michael Donald. A very successful case, and as far as I have ever been able to fathom, a legitimate case, a case in which the agency argument that they used, that the Klansmen who killed the man were acting as representatives of the organization, was legitimate, an appropriate case. I should say also there is no transcript of the Donald trial, so that everything you have ever read about it comes from the memories, I guess, of people who were there, including any repertorial pieces. But nonetheless, it seems a good model of a case. That was the case that they tried to bring against Tom Metzger in Portland. They said that a young skinhead who had come to Portland, a guy by the name of Dave Mazzella, who had been a follower of Tom Metzger's, had been in Portland 5 weeks at the time of the killing, had caused the death of Mulugeta Sarab by whipping up these members of Eastside White Pride. Things which seemed questionable to me, even at the time, on two grounds. One is Metzger's organization was not really an organization. War was a movement. White Aryan resistance was a movement, nothing with a corporate structure. It was a newspaper. It was an answering machine. It was part of a flux nationwide. And secondly, I already knew that the Portland skinheads did not have the relationship to Dave Mazzella that was important for the Southern Poverty Law Center's case, because I had talked to them so much earlier. They'd said, you know, who is this creep that came from California? He'd gotten out of there pretty quickly. He was not somebody who was acknowledged by the skinheads as their leaders. So the trial was put on, very dramatic, very tense, very, very intense trial, and it was the story of an outside agitator. It was the story of someone coming up from California to corrupt our innocent Oregon children, who never would have killed Mulugeta Sarab. This racial crime would never have occurred had not this bad guy come. Very unlike what I saw, which was the sort of slow emergence of a grassroots movement, which the skinheads had educated themselves. They had on their own reached out toward Nazism. They had discovered it on their own. And that's what I had been learning. So I was disturbed, fascinated but disturbed by the Metzger trial. And this disjunction between what I saw as the real and natural history of the skinhead movement and the way it was presented in the trial, eventually, you know, many years later, became the structure of this book. Part one of the book is history. It includes several parts. It has the day of the killing, which really reconstructs the life and times of the skinheads. It's kind of sociological reconstruction. It describes the evolution of the Portland youth underground in the 1980s, a period when the skinheads dominated the youth music scene in a very violent fashion. It's a history of the larger neo-Nazi movement that Tom Metzger is a part of, going back to its roots, name you may remember, of Rockwell, George Lincoln Rockwell, and others. And it includes the real history of an organization called the White Student Union Aryan Youth Movement, which was founded in Sacramento in the 70s by a guy by the name of Greg Withrow. And actually, that's where the title of the book comes from. This first sort of Nazi youth organization in the United States, they called it their 100 Little Hitlers program. They sent out startup kits to interested people all over the country. And that's where it came from. The second part of the book, Law, is the history of racism in Oregon, the story of the criminal proceedings and the sort of the incremental way they led to the Metzger trial, the rise and the agenda of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the trial itself. I should say, I left one important thing out, and that is the gist of the plea bargains was a racial motivation plea. Paradoxically, the skinheads did not want to plead guilty to racial motivation because they said it was an accident. They hadn't meant to kill him, and they would have killed him if he were white. Both those things. The importance of the racial motivation plea, of course, is that it's what allowed the civil suit to be mounted. Had there been no racial motive, there couldn't have been anyone responsible for it. So it was that chain that I was trying to get at before. In any case, I wish that in a meeting such as this, I could give you balanced reading. I could say, okay, this is history, this is law. These are the two parts of the book. But the book wasn't written that way. It wasn't, the law part of the book wasn't written to prove the history part of the book wrong. The scenes in both parts are constructed in the same way, which is by bringing to bear everything that I could find with a great deal of documentary evidence as well as personal interviews, to everything I could find that would show what the real motives were of the people, you know, acting in a particular way at a particular time, scene by scene. And sort of to let the facts speak for themselves about where, how they match, you know, whether they do or whether they don't go together. So I can't say, you know, history, law, but I am going to read two sections from the history part, brief sections, and then I'm going to come back at the very end to an observation about the law part of the book. Just excuse me for one second here. The first part I'm going to read is an introduction to what I've been referring to as the domination of the Portland youth scene in the late 1980s by this skinhead movement. And it's an introduction to a much longer treatment. Sealed into the sidewalk of a fashionable Northwest Portland neighborhood, directly across the street from a fine French restaurant, is a graffito from about 1984 signaling a new presence in the youth scene, PUSH, for Portland United Skinheads. The PUSH graffito is the single most public marker we have that the Portland youth underworld that spawned Eastside White Pride was not simply the product of a theatrical imagination, a street cabaret staged by the city fathers along with the summertime Shakespeare in the Park, but a living community of flesh and blood people, other people's children. Invisible to most of the citizens of Portland most of the time, but known to one another very well. To explore the history of this secret community is not a simple matter, since the materials for its reconstruction are so thin. Such traces of it as remain owe their existence largely to police investigations, and the police are not in the business of creating systematic archives. They are solving crimes. Since neither for the scene itself nor for the individuals who were part of it are the available sources thorough and deep enough to tell us all we should wish to know, it would be tempting to skip the effort of reconstruction altogether and proceed immediately to judgment, as many do, but that would be a mistake. For elusive as it is, the evolution of the Portland youth scene in the 1980s contains an important story. The story of the end of the World War II era, with its widespread refusal of Nazism, and the start of a new era. The transition begins with graffiti. In the word push itself, the S is still soft and round, but above it is an SWP for Supreme White Pride, in which the S resembles the backward Z of the SS lightning bolts. In another SWP nearby, the Z is more rectangular, a partial swastika, and a whole swastika appears in the sidewalk just beyond. In pushes elsewhere in the city, the swastika-like Z is the norm. 5 years after the first swastikas, and a few months after the death of Mulugeta Sarah, I was standing in line with some friends at the Pine Street Theater, that's a rock venue, when there emerged from the parking lot a platoon of 10 Nazi skinheads. Black-jacketed, black-booted, with shining heads and faces, they stood by in formation, a strange contrast with the disheveled punks also waiting in line, as their leader conferred with the club bouncer, who held his ground firmly, no entry. I do not know who those particular skinheads were, nor does it matter to this story. What I do know is how frightening they were, and all the more so because they were young and drunk. Their leader was a round-faced, rosy-cheeked, all-American teenager who looked as if he had just stepped out of a Hitler Youth recruiting poster. The followers looked all too eager to be led. Standing only a few feet away from them in a loose crowd, I felt my sense of myself as a particular individual with a particular history seep away into something that I can only describe as a universal vulnerability, a fear that I would arbitrarily be singled out. What if, rebuffed by the bouncer, the little stormtrooper would cast about for a way to retrieve his wounded honor and, scanning the crowd, alight on me, shouting out the words shouted by the skinheads' girlfriends in this very parking lot the night Sarah was killed, "So, you're a Jew." It could have happened. It often has happened. And what would have happened next? And if this fear affected me, a middle-aged woman with some experience in holding on to a sense of self under shifting circumstances, how much more must it have affected the young punk rockers, flotsam to begin with, who, caught in what might well have become a standoff between the 10 of them and the 100 or so of us, seemed to be doing exactly what I was, staring out past the drunken skinheads across the space between us, hoping not to be noticed. The ability of a small group to control the behavior of a larger one can be described by only one word: power. In the years that followed the first graffiti, starting around 1985, the Portland skinheads had it.
You are listening to a speech by Eleanor Langer on KBOO Portland.
The next selection is about one such skinhead. It's about Kenneth Miskey, the killer, and it too is only part of a longer introduction to Miskey. And this particular section is descriptive and does not go into his background, but just so you know, he did have about the worst infancy and childhood I personally had ever heard of, beginning with being physically abused when he was 10 days old. And never being in a stable household until much later in life, when it was obviously too late. The home to which Kenneth Miskie returned when the night was done, that is, the night he killed Mulligata Sarar, was a low-ceilinged, pine-veneered, finished room he shared with Julie Bellick in the basement of her mother and stepfather's rented house in a blue-collar neighborhood in southeast Portland, not too far from the fatal corner. In another part of the basement, separated by a curtain, lived Julie's younger brother with his skateboards and bottle caps. But in Ken and Julie's section, the decor was all their own, and they had assembled it together. Posters from the local shows of assorted bands, ranging from The Accused, on which a weird mohawk-sprouting character someplace between a cannibal and an Amazon holds a dripping dagger in one hand and a skull in the other, to Portland's own Poison Idea, slide into an undifferentiated collection of anti-black and anti-Semitic posters, leaflets, and flyers that nearly covers one wall. Some, like the drawing of a microwave, Jew dwarfs, there is an oven in your future, are more or less standard issue in Ken and Julie's circles and are easy enough to come by, but others reflect an individual search. There are a number of newspaper clippings about Rudolf Hess, a picture evidently Xeroxed from a history book of Hitler and Mussolini reviewing troops, another textbook photo labeled Communists Rounded Up and Held at Bay by Stormtroopers, 1933, to which Ken has added the note, poor little Jew boys lining up to die. Elsewhere around the room, the theme continues. Their videos are Leni Riefenstahl's celebration of the 1934 Nazi Party rally at Nuremberg, Triumph of the Will, a number of recent TV talk shows featuring the White Aryan Resistance's camera-ready skinhead contingent, including Dave Mazzella, some segments of Race and Reason, a white point of view television show made for cable access by Tom Metzger. Their records, apart from such American classics as the album of the Dead Kennedys, whose jacket features the dead Jack Kennedy, are mainly British skinhead music, White Rider by Screwdriver, Oi Oi music by The Oppressed, Face the Aggression by The Condemned 84. On a coffee table by the bed, at least on the day of the police photographs, are some well-thumbed books about each of their favorite Nazis, Mengele, his, and Speer, hers. More Speer, along with William Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich as a kind of primer, sits on the shelf. There is a swastika made of gum wrappers. A sheaf of gory posters for Ken's own band, Machine, the lyrics to A Work in Progress, Senseless Violence, and the well-framed group photographs of East Side White Pride taken by Julie herself in a place of honor on the wall confirm that Ken and Julie are not outsiders to this world, like children plastering their bedrooms with posters of stars they will never meet. They are members of it. They are in it. It is their world. Ken Miskie was practically a legend. Of the waves of street kids and semi-street kids who made up the Portland underground music scene in the 1980s, some had identities and some did not yet and never would have identities, no matter how many safety pins or earrings they wore or where or what they did with their hair. And it was plain to everyone who met him, as soon as they met him, that Ken was one of the ones who did. He had arrived in Portland from Seattle in 1981 at 16, been taken up by an older acquaintance, Jim Cartland, and when Cartland joined with Mark Wells to form the booking company Cartwell Shows 2 years later, Ken came along with the territory, a link between the two promoters and their younger audiences. Stage crew, bouncer, discoverer of the hardest, farthest out, cutting-edge rock bands that he found in Seattle and elsewhere and persuaded Cartland and Wells to bring to Portland, he was visible to everyone in the rock scene, known by the stage name Ken Death, for his love of the loud, fast, violent, not for the squeamish death metal music that drove away all but the most violent listeners. With Machine, his reputation was becoming solidified, and there had been a previous band, Sudden Infant Death, but it was not so much either as stage crew or as musician that Ken Miskie stood out. It was by force of personality, energy, for there was an aura about him, a presence, that made people who knew him feel he might have what it takes to be a star. Loud, funny, wild, and reckless, pound for pound, there was more of him somehow than of most of the people in town. filmmaker Gus Van Sant, then part of the loose Portland underculture I was talking about before, even starred him in a film personifying street life on the occasion of his release from prison on a burglary charge in 1987. A two-minute rumination on women in prison, written by Van Sant and spoken by Ken from the middle of a highway. It was called Ken Death Gets Out of Jail. The year between the fall of 1987, when he got out of jail for the burglary, and the fall of 1988, when he went back in for killing Mulugeta Sarraw, was probably the happiest year of Ken Miskey's life. He had Machine, which was developing a new sound, and which in the novelty-driven, ever-evolving world of American rock music might possibly, just possibly, have been going somewhere. He had Eastside White Pride, a haven for the racist theories and feelings unspeakable elsewhere he had sharpened in prison, as well as a band of brothers he could trust on the streets. And he had Julie. Julie and Kenny were a natural match. They had met in 1984 when she was 12 and he was 19 at a smoky, drug-filled department known as Homicide House for the ambiance favored by their mutual friend Trey Tanis, also known as Trey Bundy, after Ted. And when they met again in the same place after Ken got out of jail, they knew they wanted to be together. Not only did they have a common history, they were dropouts, they drank, they sniffed, swallowed, or injected any drug in sight, they had a common vision, for Julie's racism was independent of Ken's. She had come to it on her own through study and investigation during the time he was pursuing it in prison. And unlike many of the girls who hung around Eastside White Pride, she was not only a follower, but a comrade. She could easily have been in power, that stands for preservation of the white American race. The girl-dominated skinhead crew started about then, but both in her own right and through Ken, she was accorded a status in Eastside White Pride granted to no other girl, and she liked being associated with the boys. Delicate, feminine, with a kind of sharp, fine-bone beauty that with a change of dress could have placed her on the arm of an executive or on the page, in the pages of Vogue, she was strong, bold, and scrappy as well. Sometimes she even carried a gun, and if necessary, in a street fight, she could get out there with the best of them and do her part. Life in the cluttered little apartment was not quite all swastikas and music. A photo album now part of the policed files includes some unusual items, such as portraits of some of their friends' penises, and a shot of another friend shoving a large dildo between the legs of a small skeleton. But there are a lot of ordinary snapshots as well. Friends, grandparents, an Eastside White Pride basketball game, a visit of Ken and Julie's to the zoo. Their letters, too, written during various separations, have a certain conventionality of the I love you. Do you love me? I have to go to the store. Bye for now. You know, hi, I'm back. I'm going to sleep. Good night. Zzz, here I am again, variety. That seems to lurk in the heart of every American teenager. But there are also real intimacies in there. Fantasies and confessions of the kind exchanged only by true lovers in the night. Like other couples, Ken and Julie had their problems. He strayed. She clung. They fought, sometimes violently, over things as trivial and later embarrassing as whose turn it was for the Nintendo. But their love supported their politics, and their politics supported their love. Among the photos detached from the album at some point for use as evidence are a number of pictures of Ken giving the Nazi salute, once even in a hot tub, partly clowning, as he often did, but partly not. Interspersed in the letters are the salutation from him to my dear Julie, my white patriot forever, or from her, a reference to the Reverend Richard Butler of the neo-Nazi Aryan Nations compound in Idaho, whom she invokes almost as an arbiter in one of their fights. It was the future as well as the present that held them together. Once Ken told me that one of the things that interested him about Hitler was how he had been a nobody, a transient, like a bum on the streets of Portland, and how he had risen up out of that nothingness to rule the world. And I understood for a moment how that might well attract them, for they were all bums on the streets of Portland. Ken, Julie, their friends. And without a vision, they had nowhere to go but down. Julie was even studying German. Ken and Julie planned to have a family and to be married in that order. And they were beginning to put their vision into practice. November 13th, 1988 was their anniversary. They had a cat, Heinrich, after Himmler. They wanted a dog who would have been called Rudolf after Hess. And when Julie was pregnant with the baby they both wanted but later lost, they decided to call him Joseph after Mengele. They had no plans for the contingency that the baby might have been a girl, but Eva is the name that comes to mind. I said that I'm not able to balance this kind of presentation with the legal history that's the second part of the book, but I don't want to close without a comment about it. I know that some reviewers and some readers disagree with the critique, feeling that when a person like Tom Metzger, who's had such a long-running, baleful, stirring-up role in the racist movement in the United States, feeling that someone like that is so baleful, is so sinister, that no matter that you get him by whatever means you can. This is leaving aside the question of whether he was gotten or not, which is a different matter entirely. There's a quotation from Morris Dees in my book that seems to be the point on which people divide. Morris Dees was assisted in the trial of Tom Metzger by a Portland attorney named Eldon Rosenthal, who at one point, this is according to Eldon Rosenthal, turned to Morris and said, you know, remember I said he represented himself. Eldon said, this isn't fair. We're beating him all over the place. And according to Eldon, and a remark he's repeated several times, Morris turned back to him and said, he wouldn't be fair to you in an alley. Why should we be fair to him in court? And a number of the reviews of my book have paused on that point, with people dividing. You know, I am on one side of it, and other people are on the other, and it's certainly worth airing. It's certainly worth talking about. But my own thinking has a great deal to do with you know, what my own understanding of the sources of American political freedom are, and my awareness that this was a private case brought by a wealthy organization against someone they didn't like, that didn't really have the means to defend himself. In this case, we have a good liberal integrationist bringing a case against the bad racist. But in the present climate, where let's say conservative forces are acquiring more wealth and more legal foundations and more the means and the knowledge, the skills, the precedence even to do the same kind of thing in reverse, it doesn't really take much imagination to see that the tables could easily be turned. So I thought I would close today by reading a comment from the ACLU representative in the case. The ACLU, in my view, did not play an adequate role in this case at all. They declined to represent Metzger, although they have occasionally represented him before in Southern California cases, always, you know, to great controversy, of course. But they did enter an amicus brief, which somewhat narrowed the grounds on which the case eventually went to the jury, but they did not pursue these issues on appeal. Nonetheless, the ACLU attorney, in a very brief discussion of the constitutional implications of the case, said this. He said, Your Honor, if I may recount to the court what happened in the 16th century with Sir Thomas More when he was discussing with his clerk the role of law. The clerk asked Sir Thomas More whether or not it would be permissible to ignore the law in order to accomplish a good result. Sir Thomas More asked the clerk to consider the law as the trees in a forest, and he said to that clerk, "Would you be willing to chop down those trees in your efforts to apprehend the devil?" The clerk said that he would be willing to chop down every single tree in that forest to apprehend the devil.
KABU 90.7 FM Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present The Yes Men Fix the World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KABU will be showing the 2009 indie classic film, The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm/yesmen2013.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Close Guantanamo, a public forum featuring the past president of Veterans for Peace, Elliot Adams, plus Portland's Guantanamo Solidarity Vigilers. Close Guantanamo is co-sponsored by VFP Chapter 72 and the Economic Justice Action and Peace Action Groups of the First Unitarian Church of Portland. Adams will discuss different messages about why we will be better off when Guantanamo is closed from various perspectives: Christian, Muslim, Jewish, those concerned about national security, and the fiscally minded. Close Guantanamo will be at the Elliott Chapel, First Unitarian Church of Portland, on 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, on November 7th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. More information about this event